This is Luxury.
And Diallo.
The hosts of One Song. And we'd like to thank the United Soybean Board for the sustainable makeover of our podcast studio and for sparking discussions on greener Hollywood production. Check out the Tears for Fears episode of One Song and see behind-the-scenes clips of how they pulled the whole look together. It's all on at Heartbeat Audio on YouTube, and the link is in our show notes.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
And now, join Kevin Hart as he dives into the minds of some of the world's funniest comedians. This is Comedy Gold Mines with Kevin Hart.
Welcome, world. Welcome to an all-new episode of Comedy Gold Mines, where we do what? Where we get inside the minds of brilliant comedians. And today, well, today I don't know what I can call this mind. I would love to call it a brilliant mind, but I don't know if I can. I definitely can say it's a different mind. I can say it's a peculiar mind. Honestly, man, one of my good friends in this business and a very talented fucking guy, not just comedian, but all around fucking talented, good person. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Joe McHale to Comedy Gourmands. Joe, you can't make an entrance through a podcast.
Yeah!
No, Joe, you can't.
Yeah!
For all my listeners, Joe just
Thank
walked.
You.
He just
Thank
walked
you.
Into frame. He's bowing.
Yeah. Oh. No,
it's a podcast, Joe.
It's a podcast. Great to be here.
No, Joe, it's a podcast. Like, literally, like, everything you just did was a complete waste of time.
I'm so excited to tell you my little stories that we had a pre-producer talk about. I got some zingers ready to go.
We did not have a pre-producer talk about. That's what makes this podcast so fucking good, Joel, is that it's just real dialogue. It's organic conversation. And I allow these comedic minds to show a side of them that they've never shown before. That's what this is about, Joel.
Well, I talked to somebody for 2 hours yesterday, and they said, do not deviate from the script.
Okay, Joel.
Kevin will get pissed.
Joel, that's incorrect.
He's already mad.
That's incorrect, Joel. This is ridiculous.
Yeah, Kevin, okay, you're right. I'm kidding. This is very casual. I'm just glad to see you. I'm a huge fan of In the Mix. And it's my favorite film of yours. You were amazing. What was it like to work with Usher? Tell me, what was it like? Is there going to be an In the Mix 2?
There's not going to be an In the Mix 2, Joel. You know that. That's a ridiculous question. Okay, you know I'm not doing
it. I know. There, you can't top that. You can't do better than that.
You know a funny story about In the Mix, Joel? I had to have that part. I thought that was a career-defining role, and I had to have it. And I remember not knowing if I got the part or not, and running into Usher and really, like, cornering Usher, like, hey, man, I know you saw the tape. Nobody out there is going to do what I can do for this role, Usher. Like, can you make this happen? And he's like, yeah, man. You know, this is like when he was – this is when Usher was Usher. Yeah, man. Yeah. Hand on the chest a little bit. We'll see. You know, everything's going to happen the way it's supposed to, baby. Yeah, soft-voiced me.
And so he never gave you an answer. He was just like.
He never gave me an answer, but he's like, you definitely in it runs. Like, you know, in my mind at this point, this is a massive part. I need whatever I can. I'm trying to make it. Every part is a part that I felt was launching me into stardom.
Right.
And, you know, little do you know, a lot of these parts are nowhere near what you think they're going to be.
Yeah, a lot of these parts make it worse sometimes.
Joe McHale, Joe, where are you from?
Well, I grew up in Seattle. Have you been there?
Mm-hmm. I have been to Seattle, Joe. I'm a fan of Seattle.
Yeah, but hey, speaking of Philadelphia, when I was a kid, I lived outside of Philadelphia for 2 years.
I was going to say, you didn't spend that much time in Philly.
Well, you can hear the accent.
No, I can't. You don't have a Philadelphia accent.
No, we lived in Haddonfield.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Jesus.
For 2 years. I loved New Jersey because you could trick-or-treat after school.
Yes. Very true.
Well, you have to wait until the sun goes down and it starts raining in Haddonfield. And then it snowed. It was beautiful. And my parents said, there's no mountains here. We're getting out of here.
How old were you? How old were you doing your stint in Jersey?
36.
No, Joe, that's you. Now I'm saying, how old were you when you were there, Joe? And
oh, you thought I was 36 now? God bless.
No, I know you're not 36 now. Jesus Christ. Come on. Are you? I'm looking at you.
I see. I was eight. Okay. I was eight, and I loved it. But that's when I feel like Philadelphia was, my dad was like, I don't know if this is going to be a city anymore. And it was when, you know, things were rough. And then we went to Seattle, which was even more depressing at that time.
But Seattle for you, I mean, look, as depressing as it may be to some, Seattle's a beautiful city. By the way, we know why the tone of depressed is always attached to Seattle, and that's because of the rain. I mean, goddamn, it rains. Yeah. It rains so much. And a lot of what are they on in Seattle? What's the drug of choice there? Heroin.
Heroin?
It's a big heroin.
Yeah, that really came in great in the 90s. It really put us on the map. It affected our music. I know you were a big fan of Soundgarden. You talk about it all the time.
What are you talking about? I mean, is there anybody bigger? Come on.
Well, Nirvana and Pearl Jam, but yeah. when you play there, what venue do you play? Do you play like an arena?
Yeah, I do the arena there when I go there.
Yeah, I've never done the arena. That's
in Seattle?
That night? No. I do like Chuckles Comedy Club near the airport.
Still, what about now? You crazy. Joel coming back to Seattle. The Return. By the way, you can keep that. The Return.
The Return?
Yes. Joe McHale.
Why can't we talk about, is there going to be a sequel to Night School?
Because I don't want to talk about. This is a podcast for you, not about me, okay? This is for the people to understand you. Don't boomerang this.
I just feel it's really great that you are expanding into more dramatic roles. And, you know, when I saw The Upside, I was like, man, they found a wheelchair that Kevin can look over.
Okay.
And, all right. That's, above.
That's a lot.
Brian's that's head, a lot. And you're like,
that's a fucking lot. That really is a lot.
Is that?
That's a lot, Joe.
Was that too many in a row?
No, this is why I love you, because they're always good. They're never bad. Here's my question, Joe. Is it one Joe? Is Joe from a family of just you? Or is there more? Is there more personalities, more funny minds around you? Any siblings?
Oh, I mean, do I have like a disorder where I have multiple minds in my brain that are telling me to kill?
Or brothers and sisters, Joel. Do you have brothers and sisters?
Oh, I have a mom and dad and two brothers. My dad is a very funny man.
Okay.
The poor guy had three sons, all within 6 years of each other. And 4 years of each other, excuse me. And Irish twins. And his nickname for us was Jerk. And it wasn't individual. All three of us counted as Jerk. Just like the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit all are God, right? He was just like, Jerk! And then we would all come.
Now, what's the separation? You said you have two, you say Irish twins, but I mean, what's the separation of age?
I guess 20 months for one.
Okay.
And then the other is just over 2 years. So one's an electrician in Seattle.
Okay.
He works for the Seahawks. And I'm like, how was your day today? And he goes, I didn't blow myself up. And I'm like, great day. Like, you think about us, we're like, I mean, for you, you're like, will my private jet have the sparkling water that I ordered? What the fuck? And like, he's just not trying to get blown up. And then my little brother is an Episcopal priest in
Oakland,
California. Yeah. But it's an Episcopal priest, which means he can be married and have sex with his wife. And they have a lot of sex. A lot of very, and she's a minister, so think about how ecclesiastical their sex is.
By the way, what's even better than that is, you know, you the funny side of it is you having a priest for a brother and you being the way you are. I mean,
yeah,
your humor definitely doesn't turn down, so your brothers know who you are, they accept you for who you are, and they've dealt with this side of humor for quite some time. The transition to comedy for you, though, to them was what? Was it something like that they supported, or was it like, what the fuck are you doing, Joe?
Oh, they had no choice. We all had some. Well, my brother and I, older brother, had learning disabilities, and my younger brother was the smart one because he could read, and the priest. And so my older brother and I, we were like dyslexic and ADHD, and my dad's dyslexic, and he still won't admit it. It's great.
He never took the test or anything. Just never did.
There wasn't really tests. And there wasn't tests when I was a kid. They just told me I was slow, and I'm not kidding. They said I was a slow starter, and I was like, what is that?
So you were never tested. They just diagnosed. By the way, that's kind of how they did it back then.
Yeah.
There weren't any like real exams or anything that you had to take. They kind of just said, your kid's not doing this fast enough.
Right.
He's gotta be said thing. And they just slapped it on you.
Right. And they always go, we should hold him back. That's what their big solution was just have him redo the grade. Instead of like, hey, he's got his shit together when it comes to everything else, but maybe there's something we can do to help him read. They're like, nah, just have him do second grade again.
He's just not processing this. Nah, it doesn't matter. He needs to do the whole thing again.
Yeah.
For you as a kid, you know, at that time, I mean, for you and your brother that was going through the same thing, did that affect you at all? Or were you guys just rolling with the punches?
Oh, yeah. It turned me into an actor, which, you know, is the most insecure, people on the planet.
Yes. Okay.
Because if you know, like you feel pretty good about yourself, but if one person says, hey man, I didn't like The Secret Life of Pets, you'd be like, but what did I do wrong? And then did you like Secret Life of Pets too? That was worse. And then you're like, ah, and you know, one little poke and actors just fall apart. I do at least. And so I just cheated through everything. I can't spell a word still. I cheated through high school and college. And all the whole time I was just like, well, school's not a thing for me, but I love sports and I love acting. So I'm gonna do that until the bad acting police arrest me and make me get a real job.
I love that you're so open about it, honest about it, you know. When my son was younger, they tried to do the same thing to him. They tried to like just say that he wasn't processing information as fast as the other kids. I was like, it's school. What are you talking about? He don't want to be here. I said, that could be the thing too. I said, it's not a video game. It's not exciting.
Yeah.
So when you're saying he's not participating in class, I was like, he don't want to be there. It's not rocket science. I was like, he's not slower. He just don't want to do it.
Yeah.
So we'll tell him to do it, and then he'll probably do it at an average level just to get by, but that doesn't mean that he can't do it. Like, I had to literally tell the school that my son was a kid and, like, make them understand, like, you do know that kids don't love to go to school. You do understand, like, there is a side of children that just don't want to be here.
Right.
Right?
And then but there's one girl in the front row. She's so happy.
She's in there.
She's nailing it. And
lock the fuck in.
There is just motivation alone. There's so much to be said for that, because so many kids are just not happy.
Were you ever scared towards the end of the road in school about what you were going to do?
No, in seventh grade, I figured out that I was going to be an actor. I was like, that's what I want to be.
Wow.
That's what I'm going to try to do. And even when I got to college, this little voice in my head, I would like sit and pray. And they were like, voices like, hey, you're supposed to be an actor. You're not supposed to be doing all this stuff. And I was like, wow, trying to be on the football team and doing all this stuff. And then I got a job on a TV show in college. And I was like, all right, I'm quitting football. I'm going to be on this show. And that was kind of the beginning. And that's why I was able to be on basic cable for almost 12 years. Basic cable. That was like, it was not part of the premium package.
I would say this, right? I would say the thing about you, Joe, is like there's two different versions of funny. You got the funny that's kind of forced, learned, and then you got the funny that's natural. You are a natural funny. So you saying that you kind of knew, and when you say acting, I mean, at this point, are you talking about the world of art behind acting, or you just knew you wanted to be in front of the camera?
Well, it's very uncomfortable to hear you compliment me. And because I feel like our relationship is just filled with insults being flung on either side. And then when you compliment me, it makes me powerless. It renders me mute. So I don't know how to respond, because I want to go like, hey, I really love The Wedding Ringer, and you were great as the ring bearer because you were the right height. And I can't do those jokes when you compliment me. What am I saying? I was in plays, and in high school, I got an agent and I got headshots, and everybody and their mother was auditioning for Twin Peaks because it was shot in Seattle. And there was a couple other TV shows, one called Northern Exposure.
Oh my God, I remember that show.
Yeah, it was these. And I tried like hell to get on them and I couldn't. My whole thing was like, I'll do anything. Mm-hmm. I just want to perform. And I started doing improvising. I started at a theater that just, it was all theater sports and stuff like that. And so
I was gonna say, in Seattle, they didn't have like comedy troupes and stuff like that.
There was a very good improvising like scene. Like I did not do stand up until after I started The Soup. So I didn't participate, not really.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Joe, I thought that you were a stand up first.
No.
I didn't know that you started after.
No.
How late? Well, I don't wanna jump far too ahead because I'll get there. And as you'll see, Joel, I'm really fucking good at what I do, like in this podcast thing, in the journey of discovery and who the fuck you are, right? Because it's not about me, it's for the listeners.
You really are incredible. And I think your best role was in Meet Dave. I thought you were amazing. And I was like, that's Eddie Murphy's brain, and he's in his brain. It's crazy.
He's doing stuff in Eddie's head.
I was like, he's in his brain, and his name's Dave. And I was like, is that Dave with Kevin Klein movie? No, it's a different Dave. That one has the word meat in front of it. I auditioned for that movie, and the director's note was he tanked the second audition. That hurts.
Okay, so you got your fucking career figured out. You know what you want to do, but your brothers don't, right? They didn't at that time.
No.
So how did they feel? I mean, were they supporters of the world of Joel in acting? Were they on your side?
They were supportive. It was everybody else that was murmuring behind my back.
Mom, dad?
My mom and dad, they were like, it was like a arm's width length of support in the beginning where they were like, that's nice. That's great. Have you thought about getting a real estate license?
Okay.
And I'd be like, no, I don't think I'm going to be good at that. And but they saw me in a play and they were like, hey, you're not terrible at this. And my mom was very like, she helped me like get, she was like, you should definitely do this internship. But everybody else, all my friends were like, you need to go to law school because when you get done with that, if you don't become a lawyer, you can get more money at this company. You can enter, you know, have an entry level job that's paid more. And when I would hear that, I thought I just would love to live in a tent and drive around like Jim Carrey did with his family in a van somewhere in Alberta. And
figure it out.
Yeah, I was just like, that seemed impossible to me. Because did people think you were crazy when you were like, nah, I'm just going to go stand on stage and tell fart jokes. That's how it's going to go.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think nobody believes in the comedian until the comedian starts to do things that people go, oh shit, I can't believe you did that, or hey, I saw you on, or his shows are now at.
Right.
Nobody believes in the guy that says I want to be funny for a living. Not in the beginning.
I'm trying to think of what other career, if you don't have any credits and you say you're a thing, right? There's almost zero respect. And then as soon as you get on something, then they're like, we know him.
Yes. Yeah. There's nothing that comes close to the world of stand-up comedy.
No.
The world of comedy and the journey that individual has to take to become somebody is one with a lot of disrespect in the beginning. Because the new comic is not treated great.
No. I don't know.
They're just not. They're not treated great, you know, from where you got to go perform, from how you're paid when you perform, from the road gigs, how you get to the road gigs. You know, there's a lot of fucking struggle before you get to the smallest win.
Yeah.
There's a lot of struggle, right? And, I mean, you're talking about stand-up comedy after, so you actually had a win before. At least you had some financial security of some kind, right? Because the soup, how you were on the soup for how long? You said you started it
2004.
So at that time you were on the soup for 12 years.
Yeah. And then E decided to shut down the comedy brand.
Got it. So you're saying you started after. Okay. I'm thinking.
I was in Seattle in the late 90s and I was on a television show there called Almost Live, which actually was on Comedy Central for a while, but I was not on that part. And it was a very, unique show in that it was at an NBC affiliate, but it was local. So we pushed SNL to 12:05. And before that, a local sketch comedy show came on and it was a big, huge success in Seattle. And I came on very late in its run. So I went from college to getting on this TV show, which was
massive.
That was a grand slam for me. And that overnight, practically, I started appearing on the show and all of a sudden the thing I'm talking about where people are like, you're going to be an actor, you're going to be in your little community theater, to what are you doing tomorrow? Would you like a free meal? And wow. Like literally restaurants would give me free meals. I'm like, what is this world of people? I mean, I was so happy. And then I went to acting school because I was like, I know I can't do this forever. I better go to acting school. I did that and the show in Seattle at the University of Washington. And then I dragged my poor wife down here in 2000 when you were, you were 5'4 at that point. You were pretty, well, you're still growing.
I'm still 5'4. I get what you're doing. I get what you're doing. Nothing's changed with my height.
Oh.
Nothing's changed. It's fucking very sad that you would stoop so low.
Well,
like, I get what you're doing.
It's ironic that you say stoop so low because you don't need to.
It's fucking two in a row.
Okay. So then, I'm so sorry. I can't help myself. But I want to say Get Hard definitely needs a sequel. I want to hear about Real Husbands of Hollywood, because that, when I heard you were back on that, I was just like, cha-ching, yeah. And I was like, if you look at that list of guys and you see Kevin's face and you're like, where does that money go? It goes to him. He's being paid. It's not Robin Thicke. God bless him. I love Robin. Kevin's getting all the money. And Kevin's like, that is true. That is true. All right.
I want y'all to understand, like, this is our real relationship. This isn't like today. This isn't just for now. This is what the fuck we do nonstop. Literally every encounter, every time we see each other talk. This is what it is. It's the best.
When we did your game show on E just to get your wife laughing at my jokes about you, I've never been happier in my life.
Bro, she's a fan, and I had to explain to her what you do. She's like,
he's like a large white man who somehow has more hair than he used to is
she
going to be.
She thought you were the Rams coach. She thought.
Sean McVay's gonna be on the show. No, that's not.
It's Joe McHale.
She's like, oh, that's great. What's he been in? Oh, okay, that's great.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. The Daily Show podcast has everything you need to stay on top of today's news and pop culture. You get hilarious, satirical takes on entertainment, politics, sports, and more from Jon and the team of correspondents and contributors. The podcast also has content you can't get anywhere else, like extended interviews and a roundup of the weekly headlines. Listen to The Daily Show, Ears Edition, wherever you get your podcasts.
Justin, and so good. Thousands of spring deals at your Nordstrom Rack store. Save big today on new arrivals from Kate Spade New York, Nike, Sam Edelman, Free People, and Madewell, starting at only $30. Great brands and great prices on dresses, denim, sandals, designer bags, and more. So rack your look and get first dibs on spring styles you want now. From just $30 at your Nordstrom Rack store. What will you find?
How the fuck you get to LA? So you just randomly decide to move to LA?
I said, I have to try it down here. And I said to my wife, who still loves the Northwest more than anything, and I was just like, I need 5 years. And if after 5 years it's not happening, I will go back, I will get my real estate license, and I'll get my Starbucks card, and I can walk to, we'll go back. And year four, well, I had booked a small role in Spider-Man, which I shot in 2003, no agent. Mm-hmm. And then
this is crazy, Joe. This is just all hustle.
This is
all just you.
I could not get any. I couldn't get an agent at all. Yeah, and then I finally got a commercial agent. God bless this company called AKA Mike Abrams and Doug Eli. I could book commercials. And so I started booking commercials. That was about 2 years in. And I still couldn't get a regular agent to send me out. And I thought, I guess I'll just be. My goal will be to be the greatest commercial actor of all time. I was like, well, this is what I'm going to do. And then I booked The Soup because Annie Roberts, who was the booker at E, which I'm sure you've come across a couple times. Mm-hmm. And she saw commercials and kept bringing me in for like Best Week Ever and Celebrity Oops and stuff like that. And these little specials where the comedians would go, I saw that clip from that thing and let's make fun of it. And then
yes.
I booked the, it was, it wasn't even.
I did those, by the way. I did those. Yeah. Like you're saying, it was the Best Week Ever or Craziest Things of 2000 and. Like year's greatest, blah, blah, blah. You're just doing a recap and the comedians are basically giving their feedback on what happened during the video. Yes, I did those as well. Big hits for me at that time.
And yeah, it would be like, what did you think of the thong song video? And then it would be like, well, I wear my thong, and you'd make a comment. And I did those and couldn't get in. Then I booked The Soup, which was never like the answer to Talk Soup at that time. And I had no agent. My friend Jason Burns from high school was he worked at Gersh and he was an agent. He's like, yeah, we can't represent you here because nobody will be excited about you. I'll just hip pocket you and try to send you out, which was so good because he was so honest about it. He's like, nothing will happen if you get here because you have no credits. I'm like, okay. And then The Soup happened and no one watched it for a year. We sat every Friday night at 10 o'clock trying to make ourselves laugh. And just because I hired a friend from high school and his name's Dominic DeLeo. He appeared on screen all the time with me. And then we just fucked around, but it was getting enough of a number that, and it was so cheap because me and a curtain and a camera that they were like, all right, fine. And after a year, all of a sudden, it started working, and then Gersh called, and they were like, we'd like to take you to lunch. And I'm like, oh, wow. I mean, yes. Then I got to the lunch, and I had been paying them commission, because I've been paying my friend. And to make up for that, because they hadn't been sending me out on anything else, I ordered an $800 lobster. And so with eight agents, and I was just like, what's the most expensive thing on the menu? They're like, we have an 8-pound lobster. It's 65 years old. I'm like, kill that and bring it to the table. And this huge lobster, I was like, what's your most expensive wine? They're like, we have an Opus 1 from 1978.
Bring it.
And these agents were looking at me. They were just like, what the? Yeah, it was great. So then I got an agent and The Soup started working, and that's kind of how it started. Because I knew, because all my actor friends were like, I would never do a show on E like that, because it would kind of dilute being an actor. But I'm like, Greg Kinnear ended up with an Oscar nomination, and he started doing it. And as soon as people noticed I was on that show, instead of going out for the third best friend in a pilot, I all of a sudden was getting like, oh, you could, the lead in the pilot auditions. I wasn't booking them, but I got those auditions. And so that's how that kind of went.
You know, it's crazy, Joel, is like, listening to you talk, man, listen to the story. I didn't know how crazy the journey was. I didn't know how independent, the work was that you had done to get you to the opportunity, right? Mm. And what I find is that, man, in doing this and talking to all these comedians, it's crazy because none of the stories are the same, but they're all similar.
Yep.
Like the crazy struggle of how is so intriguing. You just find yourself listening in disbelief. Like we're like, look, I said, fuck it. I moved from Seattle. I get to LA. I tell my wife, this is the timeline. I mean, goddamn, I got to figure it out. But shit, I'm not. I'm getting commercials. By the way, huge win. Yeah. Huge fucking win because you're at least in a place where you can feed yourself, right? Like you're making some money, right? Like that's, yeah. which is very dope, but it's a bittersweet because it's not doing what you want to do and you're still trying to get to what you want to do.
Right.
And the hustle of, oh, I got Spider-Man, which was crazy. I just got that and I didn't have an agent. Then I did this thing where my friend was there. So he was just kind of helping me, but then I get the soup and that was basically nothing for a year. Then it started to become something. After it started to become something, it was one of those things that became a part of your night, whether you wanted it to or not. Because when you would flip channels and you got to the soup, something about the soup kept you there. It's another fucked up moment where I got to give you a compliment. It was, we're talking before the world of Ridiculousness. We're talking before the world of Tosh. You know, we're talking like the first to really grab the world of what the world is doing, what's internet friendly, and what are we playing back that happened and what are we commentating on?
Yep.
You were the first real host attached to this type of IP, right? Like it wasn't really being done at the level that it is now. And it kept you there because it was fucking funny. Looking at that now, do you realize that now that like you were like first to fucking market?
With the time, well, we were like, we're just standing on the shoulders of Greg Kinnear and John Henson and Aisha Tyler and Hal Sparks. Cause we were like, well, they kind of came up with the format, but we did it instead of doing it daily, just about talk shows. We did it about everything and it was half an hour once a week. So it was a real wrap up and people forget that it was, now that it's a while ago, but it was the open frontier of reality shows. It was just as they were beginning and you got your RuPaul's Drag Race, the early version, which was nothing like this one. Being Bobby Brown was an insane show. You had Britney Spears and Kevin Federline just walking around with video cameras, and that was a show. And so we were
Paris in the beginning.
Yeah,
too.
And Survivor and Extreme Makeover Home Edition.
Yeah.
And they would just be like, we're gonna do one called Naked and Afraid, and we're just gonna drop it. And so it was like Bear Grylls started. It was Steve Irwin was still around, and it was just this open. I mean, Flava Flav's Flavor of Love was wild. I mean, a woman took a dump while walking up the stairs. And
by the way, you got a whole season right there. Flavor Flav cracking the crab and eating the crab on live TV until this day. Until this day, Joel, may be the best television I've ever seen in my life. Flavor Flav
is
eating a crab with no conscious to how disgusting he was being.
That sound, I mean, if you just had the sound alone, it was so.
Oh my God.
Think about it, like, he was
that alone.
A huge TV star. He was like the Flavor of Love. Then it became the surreal love with he and Brigitte Nielsen just had that, you know.
It was huge.
It was huge.
Huge. That was the time. I mean, you're saying it, but like to the listeners, like this was really, as Joel just said, the beginning stages of all of that, of that reality whirlwind.
Yeah.
It ends. The soup ends. Fuck.
Soup ends. And it ends quickly. It's ironically, that's 2015 is when it ends, mm-hmm. and or 16. And I had just signed a new contract and then they ended the show 3 months later. And then here's something I haven't ever said, but E didn't realize that they had guaranteed my contract And
wow.
So the good news was like, all right, well, now you got to pay me.
Wow.
And they were like, but they didn't know that it was guaranteed. They had overlooked that.
Wow.
And that was
what
really.
What the fuck is with you striking gold and luck on the money train?
That worked. That look, I don't even have close to the kind of money you have. But I mean, I wish I had. You have my money in a bowl in your front room for bus tokens, basically. And but that worked out. I mean, it was just good. The e-comedy brand died because Chelsea left and sadly Joan died. And then the Writers Guild came down on E, which they should have, because there was technically no writers. Everyone was a producer. And so they could repeat shows forever. And then when the reunion came in, you had to pay for every rerun. So the soup would go like 30 times a week and it went down to once. And I was like, wow. This is going to end very quickly. And wow. Once you don't get something or something goes away, no matter what, like you, it still pisses you off and you're demoralized from it a bit. And
absolutely.
Yeah. And I, you know, like I was very happy doing it. And then Community ended that same year. And I used to see you at Paramount because you were doing the Real Husbands, I think.
Yes. That's what we were doing, Real Husbands.
But I, you know, like coming now, I'm going to compliment you. I learned something from you, which was you can wear a winter hat indoors whenever you want, and you won't get too warm as long as you keep the temperature of the room.
I don't pull them all the way down.
Low.
I don't pull them all the way down, man. These are little beanies. Sure. You know what's funny? The name of them are little beanies. That's why I buy them. They're called little beanies, Joe.
I'm surprised you have to buy them. I'm assuming. Saying little beanies now, there's going to be a parachute with a crate dropped onto your home.
Well, I knew you would take the bait and say something, and that gave me an effortless plug and approach to get there. So now, little beanies, well, guess what? We're in business, baby.
That
me and little beanies.
Very good. But I learned from you, never fucking stop. And I'm not kidding.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know if it's healthy absolutely. Or not, but I was just like, there's never waiting around for anything.
That's what I was going to ask you, right? Like when you 12 years, here's the good and the bad with that. It's scary, right?
Yep.
12 years of the same thing would scare me because you fall into such a routine.
Yeah.
And there's such a, you know, a high level of consistency with expectation. My checks come here. I show up here. I speak to the receptionist here. We do our rights, table reads, writers, everybody here. And it's like, okay, wow, this is it. And for 12 years, if I'm in this machine and then somebody just cuts the machine off, there is a moment of, wait, what the fuck am I supposed to do now?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's how you know, a lot of the talent in this town gets rocked.
Yep.
Because some of this talent, they were in TV shows for years. Some of them not even years, maybe a couple years, but they assumed that this is now life and they don't understand how fast these things come to an end. It happens, snap of a finger, yep. It's over, yep. Right? It's done. And I think that's something I've always had in the back of my head as a reason to just make sure you got a lot of things in a pot. Like, I don't, like how many pots can I have going at the same time? I don't want to just have one because if somebody knocked that pot over, I got to start all over. Like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Like, it's just been more of a fear. And I think that's the big thing about comedy and what it gives us. It gives us a great third leg to stand on.
Oh yeah.
You got three legs, right? And that's a big deal in this business.
A fourth leg if you're counting the size of my penis.
Joe. We were on such a good fucking run. I mean, it was like literally getting to a space to where we're making it all make sense. We're like, we're laying the groundwork. We're following your fucking journey. And as we're talking about just having the wherewithal to want to do more, right? You throw in a dick joke. Like basically I was segueing into you not giving up, not quitting, and wanting to do more. And you throw in a fucking dick joke. You proud of yourself, Joe?
I got lost. I forget where we were because I felt like that dick joke landed. And I think a lot of people are still like,
you think they're laughing? You feel like a lot of people think they're still going crazy.
But you're right in that. So like after the soup was over, community's over, really nothing was going on. And I hit the road.
Community was big though. Before we go to you hitting the road, you can't just skip past community. Community was big.
Well, community became big, strangely, in the last 3 years. And it, at the time, it was a definite fan, like mm-hmm. cult favorite. But it was never Modern Family or Glee, which was what we were always
up against.
The NBC and the Sonys were always like, well, you know, George Clooney, he guest starred on Modern Family. Who do you guys have? They're like, we got Jack Black for one day. And they were like, oh, that's good. But I mean, George Clooney was there for a week.
Yeah.
And Jack Black, he's like, and they're like, oh yeah, he's great. But one day. And he's kind of friends with Dan Harmon. But that was just a favor. But yeah, no, believe me. Yes. That was why during the soup, when community, the opportunity came up, because I did a few other pilots that did not go. I didn't want to quit the soup while I was doing community.
Nice.
So I did both. I literally would say things like, I would Kevin Hart this thing and do both at once, and I'll sleep at some point.
Fuck yeah.
But yeah, maybe in a year or two, I'll finally lie on a pillow and sleep for 4 hours. But I was so happy. I was like, yes, this is what I've always wanted. And it's happening. And it's happening all at once. And I'm like, fine, just keep it coming and I'll figure it out. And that's kind of the attitude, because I enjoy it so much. I love acting. I love the comedy. I love doing it. I'm like, I don't ever want it to stop. Sure, my family's like, calm down.
Yeah.
But yeah, when I remember seeing you at Paramount, I'm like, you were doing the reality show while you were like, you had like two movies out. And I was like, yeah, that's how I think you're right about the point of like, so many actors or whatever think that, oh, I got on a show, I'll be here for 7 years. And that is so rare. That is like seeing lightning strike twice in the same spot. It doesn't happen.
It really does not happen, man. I'm like, I truly do feel like what you're saying is not only valid, but the proof is in the reality of you and like what you've been through. I mean, 12 years on the show is unheard of. It's unheard of. It just, it really doesn't happen. Like when you look at these Law and Orders and you look at the, I don't even know the name, SUV and all,
yeah.
Like these shows,
CSI, SUV.
I mean, dude, like, it doesn't happen. That's like, it doesn't happen, which is why they hold on to them and they'll keep doing, but those actors and actresses are part of a very, very small percentage of this business. And that it's just very rare.
Hi, it's Stephen Colbert, and I'm here to tell you about The Late Show Pod Show, which is the podcast of The Late Show with me, Stephen Colbert, and I'm here with my producer of the podcast, Becca. Hi, Becca.
Hi, Stephen.
So what do people get when they listen to The Late Show Pod Show? Let's sell this thing.
The extended moments, for sure, because we run out of time for broadcast, but we have plenty of time on the podcast.
It's kind of like being a live audience member of the show because you get things that no one else hears. Listen to The Late Show Pod Show with Stephen Colbert wherever you get your podcasts.
For you to do community, I think it's smart as fuck while you're in it. But goddamn, you know, the world of community was a crazy one because of the personnel you were around. I'm not a big fan on talking on people, gossiping on people. I never have been. But I am curious to know about Mr. Chase, right? Because like such a comedy icon, such a legend, right? But you know, I know during that show there was the ups and downs of just, you know, we're dealing with Mr. Chase and that world of whatever the fuck that came with. Did that play a toll on you at any part?
Oh, well, you know, I don't think it's any secret now that, and I think Chevy would admit it, that he was not necessarily the easiest person to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would go, fuck you. And but the guy, you know, like, I don't think it's a secret anymore because people are like, I hear he's a little difficult. And I'm like, no, he's very difficult. And there could be moments where he was great, but I think mostly he didn't really want to be there pulling those hours, and the hours were really bad, but he, I don't know if you've ever worked with him or met him, but, he just did an interview for CBS where he was like, they asked him, they were like, do you think people say that you're difficult to work with? And he was just like, I don't care what the fuck they say. I'm happy with myself. I'm like, all right, well, I would joke around with him, but I would fight him. We kind of fought physically a number of times, because he always was wanting to roughhouse a little bit more than a little harder than you should. And then I'd have to put him on the ground, and that was and he'd be like, fuck you, I put you on the ground. So, that happened a lot. And I was like, I'm wrestling Art Griswold right now. And, can't believe it. I can't believe I have Fletch in a chokehold. So, that was, I've always been all the cast members. I was like, well, you know, Chevy's being Chevy, and we're all like, good boy. And sometimes he could be, because when you watch the show, he's so funny. He's so funny. But like, he didn't like to do off camera and stuff like that. And I was very excited to be working with a hero. And, but he did not like the hours. He didn't want to be there. And it was,
there were moments where you felt like you lost sight of the fact that you're working with this legend. Like, where that was thrown to the side. Didn't you play a version of him? In a movie. What was it? It was called A Futile
Stupid Gesture about the guy that created, the two guys that created the National Lampoon, which became a gigantic success in the 70s. And then this guy named Kenny, he invented it, and he wrote Animal House.
Wow.
And he wrote Caddyshack. And then he fell off a cliff in Hawaii, high on cocaine. And this whole empire just went away. And so it's about him. He was kind of the Hamilton of comedy for white people in the 70s. He just out of nowhere invented this thing with his partner, and they made this empire happen. And that's where SNL, there was a thing called the Lemmings, that all the SNL folks were part of it, all the first SNL folks. And Lorne Michaels got all those people, and Chevy was a part of it. John Belushi and all those guys were there. And it was just this time of really wild comedy. And David Wayne directed this great, I think it's a great movie. And I played Chevy because I was the right size.
Holy shit. Yeah. It's crazy, because at that time he was known as the guy that cracked the code. He cracked the code on a certain type of comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, you know, it's almost like, you know, when you think about it now, you think about our generations, I think certain people are responsible for different versions of comedy that was being presented, right? You know, like Judd Apatow stands out to me because Judd had a very specific type of comedy that he's responsible for, and the movies that he was developing were very clear to be Judd Apatow type movies, right? And when you know, you can go look at the Farley Brothers, you can go down, like, there's so many other people that you can attach to different types of fucking comedy that were cracking the code. And his is definitely legendary.
Yeah, and I think that time in the 70s had so many from the, you know, you had Richard Pryor coming up, you had Steve Martin, obviously Chevy, you had Bill Cosby, he was coming out, and you had these huge stars coming out and who were changing comedy from what was the comedy of the 60s, and you know, the Robin Williamses, and those were all my heroes, you know, and they really changed the business. And obviously Chevy and Eddie Murphy were the highest paid comedy stars of the 80s.
Who was your if you had to give me three, where do you place your three? Who are your three?
Three of all time?
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. I would say Dwayne Johnson.
No, we're talking stand-up comedy, Joel.
Oh, sorry.
Stand-up comedy. Stand-up comedy.
The guy from Ride Along and not you.
Wait,
and,
Ice Cube? Ice Cube's not a...
He's so great. He's, very funny.
He's not a comic, Joel. Very That's funny. Ridiculous. We're talking about comics, man.
And then I think Will Ferrell's performance in Get Hard just was so...
riveting.
Overpowering. I mean, just, boy, I remember seeing... So, boy, I was a lover of Monty Python.
Okay.
I wore out my Bill Cosby records until they broke. Wow. I mean, I listened to that Why Is There Air album until it fell apart.
Absolutely.
And then, you know, like seeing Steve Martin movies and then seeing Richard Pryor's live on the Sunset Strip, I was like, I don't know what just happened. Those were, but I remember seeing Monty Python just going like, oh, those guys kind of look like my dad, but they're being ridiculous all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really a revelation for me.
Do we talk about Steve Martin and his greatness enough? Do you feel like it's talked about enough, Steve Martin as a comedian?
I think people forget what he was basically filling the Rose Bowls. Mm-hmm. I mean, like in the 70s, he was selling out baseball stadiums. Like he's doing what, you know, like I know that Gabriel Iglesias is doing Dodger Stadium.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, and you did in Philadelphia, right? You did
Lincoln Financial.
So imagine... Instead, there's 8 billion people on this planet now. And in 1976, there was 3.5. And he was filling 45,000 seat venues.
Insane.
And I think people probably don't appreciate what he was pulling off. And then walked away.
Yeah.
He was just like, I'm going to go do movies and get a bunch of Grammys to play my banjo. And he's did the thing that you were talking about, which is like when you get comfortable on something and something's working and then that stops, you're like, whoa, what's going to happen? He just was like, no, I'm moving on to the next one.
Yeah.
And I think Donald Glover did the same thing. When he left Community, he was like, I got a plan. And everyone was like, you're crazy. You're on a show that's working. And I was like, I got a plan. And it worked out.
Didn't he leave? Didn't Donald leave like... It was just conversation as to what was going on with him at the time, right? Because I remember at the time there were like, it was like tweets that could have been like dark tweets or like it was weird because nobody really knew what was going on. And then after that, then it went to the side of artistry and it then became about the art. But there was a lull of like personal. And then it went to like art, and then he left, and then all of a sudden, Childish Gambino, holy fuck. And now, then Atlanta, and then Childish Gambino.
And Lando Calrissian, Star Wars. And
yeah, it's like his journey is kind of dope because, you know, there's so much that was unclear. There's so many things that weren't answered that I know people probably have questions about that phase that he went through while doing Community and then leaving Community and what obviously was the best decision for him.
Yeah.
Because then he went and focused on these other things where he was able to flourish and elevate himself and his career. So, you know, I think that's dope when people have the mindset and the wherewithal to do those things. It's pretty fucking special, man.
Yeah. In my mind, in which shows you that I'm much more insecure, I'm like, this thing's working. We should keep doing this thing that's working. It's happening. And sure, we should all do other things, but this thing is great. It's happening. And he was like, nah. And it, you know, Gambino was coming up. And yeah, there was a little bit of like, there was some tweets that went out with some handwritten stuff on like a hotel.
Mm-hmm.
Hotel paper. And I remember going like, hey man, I texted him. I was like, hey man, are you okay? And it was pretty dark. And he was just like, he wrote back, put it on the soup !! As a joke. And I'm like, oh, I think he's going to be okay. He's going to be just fine.
He's okay. There's no problem at all.
But he definitely, you know, like our fourth season was rough. And I say rough, not as in rough as we were digging ditches and having to swing hammers and stuff like that. It was rough in that Dan Harmon wasn't there. And we, you know, we were a bit rudderless. We still had the cast, but, you know, he was like, to his credit, he was like, this is how it's going to be. And he was kind of like, I'm out. You know, Chevy kind of lost his mind that season and said some pretty inappropriate things. And then, you know, we ended up getting Dan back, but I think for Donald, the train had left.
It's kind of a whirlwind story, just a community. Like, there's a story in that story alone, if you guys ever decided to tell it, right? Like, the show is actually within the show of what you guys were dealing with. Like, that's the show, Joel. That's your show. That's what you should take and really develop, because the characters that went off to do big things, I mean, you guys had a lot of stars in that show. You had a lot of, like, people that work and still work in this town, but because of the, you know, the world of Chevy Chase and just what you guys are dealing with, there's a lot to be told. If you ever wanted to unfold that, fuck yeah, that's a story. That's a great story.
I gotta write a book. Will you write the foreword?
That's a great story, man. Like, you know, the inside world of Community as a show is a fucking great idea.
Yeah, I should capitalize on that, but then I get distracted.
Yes.
See, this is where you would actually capitalize on it. You'd hire somebody, and then I would go like, I'm gonna go to the gym, and then shoot, I got a crack in my windshield. I gotta take care of that.
I gotta get that.
I gotta play Call of Duty for at least half an hour. And then all of a sudden it's 11 o'clock. I have to ask you, and I know you've been asked a bunch of times, but is there somebody I got to do a scene with Steve Martin in this movie that nobody saw, but I was just like, and he came to my stand-up show after that. Is there somebody who you were like, this is my hero, and now I'm working with my hero?
You know what, man? I'll say Chris Rock is a very big, he's a huge part of like my comedy career without knowing how much of an impact he's had on it. Like, we're very close. We're extremely close friends. But as a comic, his rise was like, it was grounded, it was real, right? Like, you know, Eddie's was like, oh man, that's never going on. Shit, who can, fuck, this guy is just it's not even, that's not even capable, like, to even think that anybody could do it with Eddie.
Yeah.
Chris's was, it was so blood, sweat, tears, feet to the ground. Saturday Night Live, busting his ass, never really got like the crazy features or highlight from the show, but writing, busting his ass, doing what the fuck he can, and, you know, stand up every night, trying to figure the fuck out, writing, busting his ass.
Then bring the pain.
He's a stand-up success, and stand-up brought the rest of the success, but he's a stand-up success, and that shit played such a major impact and role in me going back to comedy when I was in LA waiting for auditions. And it's like, well, what the fuck is going to happen? Like, I need to go and do stand up, get a fan base and build that shit until it can't be built no more. And after Bring the Pain, you know, when you look at his career after that, well, it's like the world was just like, who's this guy? This is the guy. And then, you know, the jobs and the work, it was still him. He was behind the creatives. He was behind writing. He was figuring it out. And that, like, that's always stuck with me, man. And, you know, I gotta say him, Eddie, of course, just because of what the fuck he was able to achieve.
Yeah, but he was on SNL when he was 17. I mean,
that's nuts.
That's nuts. Like Mozart. You can't, it's one of those career paths that you can't go, I'll be on SNL when I'm 17. Like, yeah, sure.
It'll never happen.
I remember when Bring the Pain moved the needle Because it was all of a sudden it was like, what? But that's the guy on SNL. And now he's just an hour and 10 minutes of destruction.
Oh, my God.
I was like, go back and examine that for how to do it. And the only career I can compare it to, when you have someone like Bruce Willis, who was on Moonlighting, which was a popular show. And then I remember even seeing the articles were like, yeah, he's going to be in this Die Hard show. He's going to be an action hero. And we're like, what? No, that guy? The guy who's doing like little quips in a romantic comedy TV series that's not that popular. It's okay. But I mean, it's like, oh, no, he's going to be the biggest star on the planet. And it just went, oh, that's what we're doing now.
That's it.
And with Chris Rock, it was like, he's the guy now. And then did you know him when Bring the Pain came out?
No. That's what I'm saying. Like, you know, we've talked about, I told him all of this stuff, of course, to date. But I'm saying, like, back then, it was just a flawless stand-up special. That was a pure definition of hard work paying off.
Yeah.
Hard work paying off. That's what I see when I watch that. Yes, he's talented. Yes, he's funny. But those jokes were so crisp, so clear, so fucking, so vetted out, prepped, worked, reworked. That set has been hammered to the nine. Like that fucking set moved. Yeah. And I mean, that's what I took from it. So I would have to say him. Then of course, Eddie, man. But you know, I think for the conversation that we have had and that we're having, man, just the thing that I'm taking away from it is just the mindset to just not be content when that plate of content is put in front of you.
Yeah.
Right. That like you're giving the plate to eat from and go, I can eat this every day. Right. And there's,
yeah,
when you do that, you don't ask, well, what else are they cooking? Or are they making anything else back there? Like when you get that plate, you forget to ask about other options or what else.
Yeah. You know, this chef Curtis Stone,
I know who he is. I don't know him personally, but yes, I know.
I do a cooking show with him and I was like, how the hell did you do this? And he was like, well, mate, you know, just started working, and he's Australian, and he started working for Gordon Ramsay for free in London. Like, he flew himself there, started working for free, and I was like, how the fuck? He did the same thing that comedians and actors do in someone like you, who he was just like, oh, no, there's going to be Curtis Stone, like, cookware in 10 years, and, like, there it is. And, like, he sends me pasta makers, and I was like, that guy was just working for free as a sous chef and washing dishes, cut to this, like the Curtis Stone Plaza. And I know that we hear these, what I hate, it was like, well, if you just do these easy steps, then you'll get there too. And here's a book on how to do it. Here's 9 different motivational shit. And I was like, what it just comes down to is working your ass off every day. And it's not like, I don't think, like I saw your really good post about waking up at 4:15 to work out, which I was pissed and jealous about because I'm like, I can't do that. I have to wait at least until 5:15. But I was like, yeah, that's what it fucking takes.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean you need to wake up and be like, I'm motivated to do this, this, and this, and here are my 7 rules to being a successful person. It's like, no, I'm going to write a fart joke. And this fart joke is going to be on stage in 3 days, so it better be a good fart joke.
There you go. Joe, man, I know we joke around a lot, man, and I don't ever want that to change because you're one of the good guys. You're one of the real ones. But I have a tremendous amount of respect for you already. But after this conversation, even more, man, you know, like just when you really know the road and journey that people have taken, it just opens up your eyes just to understand them a little bit more. And I hope my listeners, you know, have had the same takeaway that I have, man, is that you're witnessing a guy, listening to a guy that has wanted it since he was 7, 8 years old and knew what he wanted to do. And there was no plan B.
Plan
A was there from the get go. And that's a dope ass thing to chase your fucking dream at that young of age and get there. And Joe, you know, shout out to your wife, right? Fucking going and staying true to the guy that had the dream, right? And still being a part of it as well. you, my friend, are dope as fuck, man. The success you have, you definitely deserve. And I hate to say it, but I hope you get more of it. I hate that.
See, the compliments are not, I'm rendered powerless.
I just said I hate it, but it's, you know, it's the podcast. I'll see you in person, I'll trash you.
One last thing I'll say about you, Mr. Kevin Hart, and this could be a compliment again. This is, it's just, we're just end up getting married ourselves. But through all your freaking success, and you know people like this, for some reason, you are one of the ones that remained kind. And you were the one that like, make just, literally just making eye contact and going, how you doing? That does not happen as much as you think when people reach these crazy upper echelons of success and their shit doesn't sink anymore. It tastes like ice cream. And you somehow, through this empire, this aircraft carrier you've built underneath yourself, still are like, hey man, how's it going? What's up? How are you doing? And I'm just, that doesn't, there's so many guys that have done well that are like, not even in that, don't do anything like that. And so that, the success there too, like be nice to everybody. You have, you know, the guys that are dicks because their reputations get around, and your reputation, everywhere I go, I'll always go like, who are the dicks? They will list usually around the same people. And I was like, who's great? And Kevin Hart is always on that list.
My guy.
And that alone to me, I'm just like, oh, right. Because at the end of my life, I'm like, it could go great. I could have a really nice house and nice cars and all that crap and things go okay. But I was like, was I a dick? And people are like, fuck that guy and never want to work with him again. And that is a huge accomplishment, what you did to be kind to people. I mean, I still don't understand why you were in that Fast and Furious move, the Hobbs and Shaw thing. Oh, I don't have to figure it out.
Christ. I don't.
But see what I did there? I had to buy it all back.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Comedy Gold Mines. You know what we do? We get inside the minds of brilliant comedians or comedic minds in general. And oh my God, what amazing minds they are. And today, unfortunately, well, it was no different. Joe, what? I was going to trash you, but I said it was no different, Joe. Way to give the people a fucking dose of greatness. Guys, listen, he is who he is. He will be who he will be. Granted, will you see him in movies soon, or you know, as a best-selling author, or you know, like an arena tour, global, something like that? No, but what you will do is fucking read his blog. Joel, tell these people where they can check out your blog.
I don't have a blog. I don't have a blog. I have a website that has like tour dates.
Don't worry, I'll cut that out. Do you want to shout out tour dates? You can do that then. I thought you had a blog. You want to shout out tour dates?
I'm playing Philadelphia. I'm on a thing called Stargirl coming out in the summer.
Yes, you do.
How dare you? Crime Scene Kitchen coming back with Curtis Stone and Yolanda Gam.
Yes.
Movie called California King. You'll see.
That's right.
Then I'm in the sequel to The Upside, and really excited. Really excited.
You will never not work, Joe.
It's called The Next Chair, and it's really great.
You will never not work. Just remember, I told you that you will never not work. You're too good.
That sounds like a threat.
No, it's not. It's just because you're too fucking good. I love you, dude. And I don't say that. I really do mean that. Love you, Chad. I appreciate you, man.
Thanks for being so cool to me, man. For real.
Comedy Gold Mines is a Sirius XM and LOL audio production. Executive produced by Kevin Hart, Ty Randolph, and Eric Weil. With Tastemakers Media, Emil Garner, and Ian McDonald.
Hi, it's Stephen Colbert, and I'm here to tell you about The Late Show Pod Show, which is the podcast of The Late Show with me, Stephen Colbert, and I'm here with my producer of the podcast, Becca. Hi, Becca.
Hi, Stephen.
So what do people get when they listen to The Late Show Pod Show? Let's sell this thing.
The extended moments, for sure, because we run out of time for broadcast, but we have plenty of time on the podcast.
It's kind of like being a live audience member of the show because you get things that no one else hears. Listen to The Late Show Pod Show with Stephen Colbert wherever you get your podcasts.
Justin and so good. Thousands of spring deals at your Nordstrom Rack store. Save big today on new arrivals from Kate Spade New York, Nike, Sam Edelman, Free People, and Madewell, starting at only $30. Great brands and great prices on dresses, denim, sandals, designer bags, and more. So rack your look and get first dibs on spring styles you want now from just $30 at your Nordstrom Rack store. What will you find?